From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Massachusetts Medical Society recommends the state open so-called supervised injection sites for drug users.
Everything we can do to keep people alive long enough to find that spark that makes it possible for them to be better, for them not to be controlled by drugs, I support.
But not all doctors do. We'll talk to a physician who says that there's a better way to fight the opioid addiction crisis. Also today, why did the Boston Police Department spend more than $60 million paying officers for overtime? And why are some of those officers working 90 hours a week? And a new study finds institutional racism is alive and well when it comes to the Massachusetts mortgage lending market. Plus, Congressman Michael Capuano gives us his 2 cents on the $1 trillion spending deal that avoided a government shutdown. That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The nation's oldest continuously operating medical society is urging the state of Massachusetts to take a bold new step in combating a modern health crisis. The Massachusetts Medical Society, which represents more than 25,000 doctors and medical students across the state, is calling for Massachusetts to create so-called supervised injection sites. These are facilities where drug users can go to inject under a medical professional's supervision. And why? Well, the opioid addiction crisis, which claimed nearly 2,000 lives in the state last year, that according to Dr. Barbara Herbert, president of the Massachusetts chapter of the American Society of Addiction Medicine.
Everything we can do to keep people alive long enough to find that spark that makes it possible for them to be better, for them not to be controlled by drugs, I support.
While physicians like Dr. Herbert see supervised injection sites as a new way to give substance abuse sufferers a chance to get help, other physicians see it as simply giving up on more meaningful ways to curb the opioid epidemic. Joining us now is one of them, Dr. Jeffrey Reynolds. He's president and CEO of the Family and Children's Association, a New York nonprofit that offers addiction treatment, youth education counseling, and homeless services. He previously served as executive director of the Long Island Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence. Jeffrey Reynolds, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Now, you wrote a while ago when there was the proposal for a supervised injection facility on Long Island that it feels, quote, an awful lot like we are giving up and just accepting rampant heroin use as a fait accompli. Why is that your take on these injection sites?
You know, for more than a dozen years, we've been pushing the fact that there's a crisis bubbling just below the surface, and in some cases way above the surface, and that we need to double down on prevention, access to treatment, and support for young people in recovery. And the reality is that whether we're talking about New York State or Massachusetts, that has not happened. That year after year in regions across this country, we've seen dramatic increases in arrests, treatment admissions, and overdose fatalities. And we haven't moved the needle, and we haven't moved the needle because we haven't made treatment more accessible. We haven't made treatment on demand a reality. And so when we think about where do we go from here, particularly, you know, you talked a little bit about physicians kind of signing on to the idea of safer injection sites. The reality is physicians helped create this problem with rampant overprescribing throughout the late 1980s and 1990s. And now the solution, instead of making sure that those folks have treatment, really is to say, well, let's just bring them in and we'll watch them shoot up and we're going to hope for the best. So from an ideological standpoint, before we even get into the practical piece of this, there are some significant problems. And it does feel like we're just saying, look, we did the best we could. We just couldn't get people into treatment. We just couldn't do prevention the right way. And the very best we can do is to help them shoot up.
So let me just jump in here because ideology and practicality meet in a very sort of a significant way when it comes to the number of people who have died due to drug overdoses in this epidemic. And, you know, when we last talked about the possibility of supervised injection sites on this program, we actually spoke with Brandon Marshall. He's an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Brown University School of Public Health. And he did a 2011 study in Vancouver at a supervised injection facility there and found out that after this facility opened, lives indeed were saved. And I just want to play you some tape. Here's what Brandon Marshall said.
What we found was that in the neighborhood where the facility was operating in the downtown east side, overdose mortality decreased by 35% after the facility opened in that neighborhood, compared to only 9% in the rest of the city of Vancouver.
So, Mr. Reynolds, a 35% drop in mortality around one of these supervised injection sites, is that not a compelling enough reason to try something here in Massachusetts? I mean, 2,000 people died last year due to overdoses.
Yeah, look, and you're talking to someone who's been to quite a few funerals so far this year, and this isn't kind of a new rodeo for me. I talk to families each and every day, sometimes 10 times a day, who have lost loved ones.
Yeah.
And so that's not lost on me. You're talking to someone who fervently supports syringe exchange. The question is, will those results be replicated in communities across your state or my state? So in my state, I can tell you that the likelihood of situating a safer injection facility anywhere on Long Island is zero to none. It's not going to happen. And if it were, how do the folks who are injecting 10 to 15 times a day get into that injection site to make sure that all of those injections are safe? And so I think the data from that study is compelling. It is important. And if some communities want to set these up, that's fine, but there are communities where it's not going to happen, and we still need to emphasize treatment. You know, one of the things we know about addiction is that every single time you put that drug into your body, you reinforce a progressive disease that in a lot of cases winds up being fatal. And so there are some stopgap measures we can take along the way, but understand this is not a solution to addiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
It might be a way of preventing some fatalities, and I don't diminish that in any way, shape, or form. But I worry that less progressive lawmakers take a look at this and say, let's just give them the needle and be done with it.
Let me just...
The Darwinian kind of conversation that's taking place around addiction at this point in time in terms of whose fault it is and who causes people make bad choices. I worry about us looking at this and saying, well, come on, we gave you this safer injection sites. What else do you want?
Right.
So I want people to get well.
So I just want to jump in here again, and forgive me. It sounds like I'm cutting you off. I don't mean to do that. But this line of thinking, these concerns that you're raising right now, are exactly some of the reasons why some of those folks voting who voted this weekend with the Massachusetts Medical Society voted in the affirmative to try these pilot programs here in the state of Massachusetts, because they were presented with some evidence. Again, I point to Vancouver, where one of these facilities opened, that having the facility there may have actually gone a significant way to increasing the number of people who did receive treatment. So let me just play a little bit more of tape for you. This again is Brandon Marshall from Brown University, who studied inside the injection facility in Vancouver. And here's what he found in terms of getting people into treatment.
They provide a pathway for folks into treatment and eventual lifelong recovery. We found that people who used the supervised injection facility were 30% more likely than those that didn't to enter into detox, particularly people who use the facility frequently and also made contact with addictions counselors that work in the facility itself.
So is that compelling to you? Because maybe it's sort of a step towards closing the gap between people who can't find a pathway to treatment.
I think it would be hopeful, and it should only play out that way. I think, look, we all want the same thing in terms of saving lives. You know, I think in some cases, you know, when you look at the data associated with syringe exchange programs, when they're executed in the right way with the right funding, they can provide a bridge to treatment. But there are a lot of questions about who is on site, what's the message that's given out to the user. And quite frankly, there's a secondary question in that right now, the vast majority of folks who are using heroin are not using needles to administer that heroin. They're still snorting it. Mm-hmm. Out here on Long Island, about 10% of users are actually injecting. Do we in some way, shape, or form increase the likelihood of injecting behaviors as a result of setting up these facilities? I don't know. I'm not ready to say absolutely we do, but I think there are other ways to get people into treatment. And quite frankly, you know, in your state and in my state, I've heard stories where it takes people 3 to 4 weeks to ever get into treatment. And so getting folks into treatment is not necessarily a hard thing to do. You simply need to ask them and then make it available. And
yeah.
I do find, you know, the notion that these sites can be a bridge to more understanding, a bridge to creating a relationship with the user and ultimately getting them into treatment, I'm not sure it's going to play out that way. And the reality might be here. It depends on how this is executed.
You know,
properly funded, where is it situated, what staff are on site.
Right. I should say that at least one physician this weekend, while the Mass Medical Society was taking its vote, said that he was disturbed that there wasn't as equally vigorous discussion about supporting efforts or pushing the state of Massachusetts to, invest more heavily in needle exchange programs or the mass distribution of Narcan. I mean, are those alternative ways to combat the opioid crisis that you would embrace?
I think they are. You know, syringe exchange programs, the data on them and the evidence is so clear and concise, and there's 25, 30 years worth of data to say absolutely they work. There are evidence-based models, and we know what the staffing should look like. We know what the messages should be. We know where they should be situated to get the most traffic. When it comes to naloxone, you know, in communities across the entire country, there are countless lives being saved with naloxone. There too, though, in our state, we've seen kind of a lot of hype around naloxone, and in some cases, those folks are never linked to treatment. And I know of half a dozen cases since the beginning of the year where the person was revived with Narcan, prematurely discharged from a hospital, was dead of an overdose 2 hours later. And so along those lines, I think we want to make sure that we're using every available tool, that we're treating this like a crisis, and that we're actually offering people a long-lasting solution. I want to help somebody live till tomorrow as well, but honestly, I want to make sure they live beyond that. I want to make sure that they're getting access to the treatment they need to get well, not just to hold them over till tomorrow morning.
Jeffrey Reynolds, last question for you, because you said something a little earlier that I want to just hear more about. We've just got a couple seconds here. You likened the opening of a supervised injection facility as perhaps leading down the road to some kind of dark social Darwinism, where we're just putting folks, you know, suffering from substance abuse addiction off in a corner, saying you got medical professionals to look after you, and not doing anything else with the problem. I mean, that is that's a very harsh take on what seems to be a well-intentioned experiment here in Massachusetts. I mean, what is your genuine greatest concern with injection facilities like this?
Well, look, the climate in which we now live, especially in the past 5 months, has changed dramatically, and that when we talk about addiction and we talk about our response to substance use, we keep saying we can't arrest our way out of this problem, yet that's what we continue to do. We've seen the stigma and the blame not fall down in the middle of a crisis, but we've seen more finger pointing than ever before. And we exist in a climate where there's a fiscal conservatism here, there's a social conservatism here, and I can imagine a place where lawmakers say, look, let's just do this. It's a lot cheaper than treatment, and the folks that are pushing for some reform in the middle of a crisis, let's just give them this and be done with it. And so, you know, look, read the comment section of any news article about addiction, and you can kind of see where a large segment of our country and how they view addiction.
Yeah.
That extends to elected officials as well. And the current climate in Washington is not necessarily hospitable to some of the things that, you know, myself and the folks within my organization care about.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's paranoid. I think it's something that we have to be on guard for.
Well, by the way, listeners, you can go back to our website, radioboston.org, to listen to the conversation that I've been referring to with Brandon Marshall, the Brown University researcher who came away with a lot of positive findings for a supervised injection facility in Vancouver, B.C. Jeffrey Reynolds, president and CEO of the Family and Children's Association, a New York nonprofit that offers addiction treatment, youth education, and counseling and homeless services. Thank you so much for your perspective today. It's much appreciated.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, there was quite an astounding figure published in the Boston Globe today. The 10 highest paid city workers all made at least $315,000, and they were all police officers. Now, we've heard shades of this story before. It's usually about officers gaming cushy union contracts to make more money in overtime, but that's not what's happening here. In fact, in this case, there aren't enough officers to meet BPD's current needs, so many of them are being told they've got to work overtime to fill in for colleagues who are sick, injured, or on vacation. Well, joining us now with more is Boston Globe reporter Megan Irons, who reported this story. Megan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So first of all, tell us, I mean, you found some pretty astounding numbers in terms of the overall amount that BPD has to pay for overtime. What'd you find?
Yeah, we found that the Police Department has spent nearly $60 million in overtime spending. And one of the reasons, there are many reasons, as you alluded to earlier, part of it was to fill shifts, cover officers who appear in court for court cases, cover officers who are working long hours investigating crime. And we found that overtime has been a big issue in the police department for many, many years. In fact, there was a city study that looked at this particular issue and found that overtime hours had increased 34% in the police department from 2010 to 2015. So there is great interest on the part of the administration of Mayor Martin J. Walsh to curb overtime hours, to rein in on how much they've been spending. In the past, the budget, the department has gone way over budget for its overtime, mm-hmm. on its overtime spending, and they've created what's called a realistic budget, but still it has been very consistent in terms of the number of the amount of money and
right.
the amount of time that officers are spending on this.
You know, in your story, you wrote about how there were a number of officers who overtime pay alone made more than $100,000. But again, that's for their overtime. But on the other hand, it's because they were working 90-hour weeks.
Yes.
And so, I mean, I'm wondering what BBD told you about the concern around having officers having put in that many hours.
Well, it's very interesting. The police department says people who work overtime do it voluntarily, and that it hasn't put an extreme strain on the department. The department has nearly 2,100 officers right now. It's about 100 officers short. We found that there have been an increase in specialty units, officers who are specialized in a particular field, whether it's, you know, the SWAT team or gang-related units, and that has been sort of straining resources on the patrol side. The city has grown nearly 30,000 people in the past 3 years. There are increasing demands for our officers to work festivals and parades and uncover special events. However, there's also other demands on officers to fill in for officers who've been sick, who've called in sick, who've been injured on the job, or who are vacationing. And what we did, we asked for the top 10 overtime earners in the police department, just to give a snapshot of what the toll it is taking on the officers themselves and the toll it might take on the city. And we found that many of these officers were working just in overtime alone, the equivalent of a salary for any other working middle-class American. And this is an issue, as I said, that has gone way back. There was an audit done in 2014 that urged the police department to crack down on its out-of-control overtime spending. There have been efforts to do that. The department has cut back spending on overtime by 15, overtime hours, I should say, by 10%. However, the spending is still astronomical.
Yeah. Megan, so another question here. There is this bigger context that we're talking about, but are there also certain aspects of maybe some of the union contracts that officers have negotiated that are somewhat advantageous to overtime? Because I'm seeing here that, for example, officers get paid a minimum of 4 hours of overtime every time they have to appear in court, regardless of how long the court appearance actually is.
Yeah. So, yes, the union contract it's been in the books for a while. Officers are allowed to work 50 hours extra. Mm. It's part of their contract. They're allowed to do that. And it allows for them to work these long shifts. In addition, there are cases in which the contract says clearly that if an officer shows up for court, even if that officer isn't testifying, if they're there for at least 30 minutes, then they're given 4 hours overtime pay. That's part of the contract. I don't think there's any appetite to get rid of those two things, but they are contributing to what some see as excessive overtime on the police force. Mm.
Well, Megan Irons is a reporter with the Boston Globe. You can find a link to her piece about overtime pay at the Boston Police Department at our website, radioboston.org. Megan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
By the way, we did reach out to the Boston Police Department today, but they did not return our calls for comment. However, we are joined now by Daniel Linsky. He's the former superintendent of chief for Boston Police. He's a 27-year veteran of the force. He's now the head of the Boston office of the consulting firm Kroll. Daniel Linsky, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, so there's a lot to dig in here, too. But first of all, I'll just ask you about, you know, Megan mentioned that the union contracts allow for 50 hours of work over a regular work week for BPD officers. Are you concerned that, like, that, I mean, that's a lot of work, 90, 100 hours a week. It's too much for an officer.
Let me clarify. The contracts don't authorize 50 hours overtime. The rules and regulations of the Boston Police allow officers to work as much as 50 hours overtime.
Okay.
And the way it works is they can only work 90 hours a week unless we tell them, unless Boston Police tells them they can work. So even though, you know, they can be aggressive and want to go out and do overtime and details, they can get up to 90 hours without violating the rule. If they go over 90, we punish them for violating the rule. If we need them, if the city needs them to go over 90 because of an emergency, they just order them.
Yeah. I guess what I was wondering is 90 hours is a lot. Period,
it sure is.
Right? And, I mean, is it good for Boston? Is it good for BPD for having so many officers who are being asked to work up to 90? That's a lot, right?
It is a lot. And, you know, when I first came on the police department, officers were looking to do overtime and details. I felt like I was missing out if I wasn't involved in the, you know, any chance I could to be in the district and answering 911 calls. This is a changing workforce where I didn't want to work 90 hours a week, but I certainly wanted to work more than my 40. There's a changing workforce now where people don't want to work much more than their 40 hours. You have a workforce who's more interested in work-life balance. And because less people are volunteering for some of the shifts, it makes mandatory assignments for others more of an option. And this is not a Boston Police issue. This is an issue that's facing law enforcement around the country. It's changed. When I was a cop, I come on, we chased robbers and bank robbers and homicide people and drug dealers. Now, ISIS is front and center in the city of Boston. Terrorist attacks are front and center and something we need to consider in the city of Boston. Our festivals, our marathons, our parades, things we used to be able to do with, you know, scarce resources to divert traffic and make sure lost children were taken care of, we now have to have a protective security element around that that extensive planning goes into.
Right.
We've created an establishment of better policing. Juries, we saw recently Aaron Hernandez's case, the amount of evidence wasn't enough for the jury. They wanted more. So we've got to become more professional, which means we're taking officers out of the patrol force into investigative services. So we get better detectives that can do latent prints and fingerprint analysis and thorough crime scene investigations. And because of the profession getting better and new challenges coming into the profession, it's causing resources to drain from the patrol force.
So what's the solution here? I mean, the Globe said that there are, what, 2,100 officers on the force right now? Do we need to recruit more?
Yeah, so I think there's no cookie-cutter solution for any law enforcement. Again, this is not just Boston Police. I was in Wisconsin. I was hired by the chiefs of police out there to do a convening session to get law enforcement leaders to think about what the new workforce, the new younger generation of work is coming in. How do we motivate them to come into law enforcement? We just had to lower the age in Massachusetts back down to 19 for people eligible to take the civil service examination. It was 20 when I took it, and we probably had 18,000 people apply for the position. I believe the last exam they gave 2-3 weeks ago, they had 1,500 people apply for Boston. That's not enough to fill the void that's going to be coming. And the administration's done a good job. The article quoted me in a couple places, but didn't get all my quotes.
Something's got to end up on the cutting room floor,
sure.
I'm afraid.
And you know, they've made challenges. So the commissioner has taken some resources back from the specialty units and put them back into patrol. I know that they had issues at the bargaining table where they were looking to take some administrative officers' positions and put them back in patrol. It didn't work out. But, you know, the Boston administration across law enforcement across America is looking at how do we better police our neighborhoods? How do we meet all of these demands?
Yeah.
Cyber wasn't an issue for us. Forensics wasn't an issue for us. How do we do all of these new things that people want us to do better with the resources that we have?
So on that point, let me ask you, I mean, part of what the Globe reported today was they took a look at particular officers and how they spent those 90 hours a week. And it seemed like a lot of what the officers were doing wasn't necessarily all these extra new kinds of duties that you were talking about, but just covering for colleagues who were either on vacation or out sick. I mean, those are sort of basic coverage needs that any organization has to deal with when employees are taking their earned vacation or out sick. And it seems like, is BPD having trouble just covering that?
You're absolutely right. We're having huge issues trying to cover the basic, you know, everyone has so many sick days, so many vacation days. We've got an aging workforce in Boston Police Department. They've been on, they're all at their maximum contract, so they all get the maximum amount of vacation time off. If you've taken the resources out of the districts that still have to, there's minimum numbers of cars that have to get filled to answer the 911 calls. If those resources have gone to great places that need to be filled, like canines and EOD detection and bomb squad and hazmat detection, things we didn't have to deal with before. But if you've taken 300 officers out of the districts to do more of the specialized work, the challenges that we have in front of us, there's not 300 officers to volunteer to fill in for that sick or vacation time. And as a result, you get a strain on resources. So and you've got limited number of people coming into law enforcement right now. The past couple of years, if we had a CEO of law enforcement marketing, they haven't done a good job. So we've got to reinvent ourselves, make sure people want to be involved and think outside the box. There are agencies in Wisconsin who are now having police and fire. Sometimes 2 days a week you're a police officer, 2 days a week you're a firefighter. And if there's a fire event, you can roll in and take your personal protective equipment out and engage in the firefighting process. If there's a law enforcement event, you can get involved with that.
And you think that'd work here in Boston?
I don't know that it works in Wisconsin. It works in that particular area. I think there's no one cookie cutter solution for this. But the administration is working hard, the union's working hard, and the city has to work hard to figure out how do we want our police to respond and how do we staff these situations. We have a lot of retired police officers. There are some of these festivals and, you know, Walk for Hunger, where officers are getting ordered on Fridays or Thursdays or Fridays. I think the legislature was working on a proposal where retired officers could go in. They could work the weekend for 24 hours, and it would take the burden off officers getting ordered on a Friday night when they have a kid's birthday party Saturday morning, to deal with some of the challenges.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's some people listening to this who are thinking an easy solution is that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be having BPD officers doing some of the duties that they're doing in overtime that maybe don't necessarily need a police officer.
Like which one?
Well, you know, we did go through
the homicide investigation.
No, I was thinking we went through that big debate over details for flagging construction sites.
Let's just be clear. Details has nothing to do with overtime. That is a separate entity where officers can volunteer in their off-duty hours to do details. We're talking about overtime here. And they can't fill the details they have. They can't fill the overtime positions they have. That's a separate incident entirely. This is talking about officers who can't fill the minimum shifts they need to staff the city of Boston.
Okay. So then $60 million a year, there's a lot, right?
Sure.
I don't think there's any disagreement that we'd love to spend that money in different places within BPD.
Absolutely.
As I said, short of, you've said it a couple of times, recruiting a new generation of law enforcement officers for the city of Boston, is there anything managerially that you think that Chief Evans, for example, could do right now to sort of take the edge off this problem?
I think the commissioner has looked towards administrative duties that are performed by officers that he could have somebody else perform. And if they can get that, that's absolutely I made some tough decisions along with Ed Davis. We disbanded the mounted unit.
Yeah.
We were the most unpopular people in the city of Boston. Everyone loves the horses. I love the horse officers. They were great. But it was costing us $4 million a year. And those horses, by the time they got on their trailer, went down to the Boston Common and reported for duty, it was 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. And then they had to leave early to get them fed and watered and get back. So we were having 4.5 hours of patrol when we were paying 8 hours a day. Plus, we had to pay for the upkeep. And for $4 million that we saved out of the budget, we were able to keep 40 police officers' positions. So, you know, we have to look at what we're doing now to see if this is and departments across the country, every couple of years, all of them should be conducting an assessment of their call volume, calls for service, the types of things they need to do, things that they need to refocus assets in, and things that they could do without.
Well, Daniel Linsky is a retired superintendent chief for Boston Police. He heads the Boston office of the consulting firm Kroll. Daniel Linsky, it's always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Back in a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Real estate racism doesn't have to officially exist, like back in the bad old days of redlining, in order for it to actually still exist. And it does when you look at the latest annual report from the Massachusetts Community and Banking Council. They found that in 86 of the state's 351 cities and towns, not a single home loan was made to Black or Latino buyers. In 2015, just 5% of white applicants were denied a home loan. This is another way to compare things, compared to 17% of Black mortgage applicants. Now, the genteel phrasing for this could be racial disparities in Massachusetts housing. But when you find out that the Mass Community and Banking Council has been doing this study for years, and for years, not much has changed, what else are you going to call it? I can come up with at least one phrase. Jim Campen is a professor emeritus at UMass Boston. He's been conducting this report. It's entitled Changing Patterns. He's been doing it for 23 years, and he joins us now. Jim Campen, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, glad to be here.
Also with us is Linda Sprague Martinez, an assistant professor of Boston University at the Boston University School of Social Work. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Jim, let me just start with you. I mean, you've been doing this for 23 years. Is racism conscious or not, alive and well in the mortgage industry in Massachusetts?
Well, there's no question that there hasn't been real changes in these patterns. They're very persistent in terms of whether you look to the small percentage of loans that go to Black and Latino homebuyers, if you look at the denial rates and the much higher denial rates for Black and Latino homebuyers, if you look at the share of their loans that are FHA loans, which are more expensive compared to conventional loans. All these patterns haven't shown much change over the last 12 years, which is when the kind of comparable data is available. So,
I mean, that's quite dispiriting, to be honest.
It is dispiriting. Broader American society is quite dispiriting. This is nothing unique to the mortgage lending industry. The Massachusetts Community and Banking Council, which sponsors these reports, is a group that's got half community people and half industry people on the board and on the mortgage lending committee, and we try and talk through these issues. The bankers try to be more responsive. The non-banks or bankers are less at the table. And
yeah,
one thing about the industry is that there are bankers covered by the Community Reinvestment Act. Who have an obligation to serve local communities. There are independent mortgage companies, which in Massachusetts are governed by state law, and there are out-of-state banks and depending on how much they're regulated, that reflects how well they perform.
So I'm going to come back to that side of things in just a second, but I want to dig into one or two other things that you mm-hmm. have in the report,
mm-hmm.
Such as some of the most dynamic and rapidly growing parts of the city of Boston, for example, that we often talk a lot about on this show because there's growing businesses, there's tech companies moving, et cetera, like the Seaport, Fenway, et cetera. You found that not a single loan generated for housing in these neighborhoods?
Home purchase loan, right.
Home purchase loan.
In eight of Boston's 20 or 23 neighborhoods, yes.
Not a single home purchase loan was granted to that Black or Latino buyers didn't even apply in these neighborhoods.
In eight neighborhoods, Blacks didn't get loans, and they didn't make any applications in any of those eight neighborhoods. Latinos didn't get loans in four neighborhoods. And in one of them, Fenway, there were two applications.
And all the Fenway, there were only two Latino applicants and no Black
correct.
Applicants.
Correct. Correct.
And what were some of the other neighborhoods?
I'm don't have them in my mind, but
okay. I remember like the Seaport being one of them.
Seaport,
Beacon Hill,
Back Bay, Beacon Hill.
Back Bay, Beacon Hill. I mean, we're talking about the expensive real estate in Boston.
Yes.
And what's driving that?
What's driving that, I think, is the real estate market. What's driving it is the huge inequalities in wealth and income among different racial groups in the city. To some extent, it's being driven by who's shown properties where. When you go to your real estate broker, who gets shown what properties? It's people self-select where they want to live.
So still, who gets shown what properties? I mean, aside from it actually being written out on a piece of paper, that seems very much like the good old days of redlining.
I think whenever paired testing is done, paired testing is you take one person who's, say, Black and one person who's white. You give them each identity, and the identity of the Black person is marginally better than the white person. You send them out to look for an apartment. You find, and they come back and report, and people analyze the data. Whenever that is done, discrimination shows up. It's hard to do that with mortgage lending because you can't get very far without actually having a credit rating and so forth. But there's some limited testing, the early stages, it shows discrimination. Yes.
So Jim, let me ask you, it seems as if, I know that members of the financial sector, of the banking sector would say, well, no racism here. It's just that when we're looking at mortgage applicants, we have to look at some of the things you talked about, you know, income, net worth or the amount of wealth that the applicant already has, credit risk, et cetera, and sometimes we find, again, race aside, we find that applicants who happen to also be black and happen to also be Latino are, quote unquote, end up being higher risk applicants anyway. I mean, that's what folks from the financial sector might say. But while that may be true, I wonder, how do we break that cycle, though? Because so many of the things that lead some of these applicants to be, quote unquote, higher risk, and therefore maybe they get rejected for a mortgage, I don't know how you break that without helping them build wealth to begin with. And isn't homeownership's the key to that in America still?
Mm-hmm. No, it's a very hard problem. And the banks are right that black people in this country and Latino people are less creditworthy. They have, in the sense that they have lower incomes, they have much, much less wealth, they have criminal records, they have less stable employment. All the things that have resulted from 300 years of oppression and exploitation in this country, from institutionalized racism, means that blacks are less able to buy a housing and less able to be able to pay a mortgage loan. I mean, that's a fact, and it's a very, very deeply embedded fact. And on top of that is layered the existing continuing discrimination.
Yeah. Well, Linda Sprague-Martinez, you've been very patient here. I haven't forgotten about you. You're at the BU School of Social Work. Can you tell me, what do you think are some of the implications for, you know, all the data that Jim's sort of put together over these many years, that we haven't really changed fundamental patterns of home loans here in Massachusetts?
I think the implications are many. When I first read the report and reacted to it, in many ways I wasn't surprised, and in some, you know, part of me wanted to be surprised because I wanted to say, oh, there's been change, but there hasn't been change. And I think the points that you bring up around the fact that these historical factors play such a role. I mean, home ownership is, as you mentioned, one of the greatest ways in which we gain our wealth in this country. And because black and Latino populations, but African-American populations historically have not been able to get into the housing market and have been systematically removed from the housing market or pushed out, they haven't been able to gain that wealth. And so now where we see even there's such great disparity in wealth between white and black families, between white and Latino families, that it continues. So even if I have a higher income and I can't still make that purchase because maybe I'm a greater risk because I don't have that ratio. And what that means for me is that if I am going to buy a house, I'm going to make that choice. I'm forced with thinking about, well, do I buy a smaller house in a better neighborhood, or do I buy more house in a neighborhood in more house with less work in a neighborhood that I can afford with a lower tax base? And when I make that choice to buy more house, maybe have a yard for my children to be able to play outside, I increase my risk in terms of neighborhood risk factors then.
Yeah.
So maybe my kids aren't going to go to as good of schools. Maybe I'm going to have more stress. There's a great amount of literature that talks about the relationship between neighborhood risk factors and health overall. And so I open up the door to this whole additional set of risk factors. And on top of that, I'm not going to build as much equity in my home over time. And so that wealth transfer is going to be smaller. But I also hurt my wealth because depending the access to education that my children have in the neighborhood that we've been relegated
right.
to in many ways. So
I mean,
so
that,
let me just add one thing to that, because you talk about home ownership and wealth for a long, and the reports are actually called changing patterns. Things do change. I emphasize persistence so far, but during the 10 years ago from maybe 2000 to 2006, there were subprime lending. Things changed dramatically.
Right.
And the kinds of populations and neighborhoods that couldn't get loans were suddenly targeted for bad loans.
Yeah.
And huge disproportionate lending to black and Latino families for loans that essentially were set up to fail. And so homeownership rates did rise for blacks and Latinos, and foreclosures followed. Mm-hmm. And so instead of homeownership in that case being a channel to develop wealth, it became a channel to lose wealth.
Yeah, more so wealth stripping practices.
Do you think that there's an opportunity here for more community-minded lending institutions to serve to serve these future homeowners who maybe are having trouble getting mortgages elsewhere from, like, you know, mentioned, like out of state lending institutions that may not necessarily have the obligations that a community bank might have, might feel.
Mm-hmm. I think there are lots of opportunities for lending, all kinds of lenders, to be more aggressive and to work with borrowers who come in to see them and who try to get them from a point where, instead of just saying no, they work with them over time to get their, to make them more credit worthy. Hmm. So that they can make a sustainable loan.
Yeah, because, I mean, Linda, you're pointing to something really important, is that there's a generational effect here. We got here through generations of racism, and now we absolutely don't want that to persist through for future generations. But it seems hard to know how to fix it when I was looking at, there's a national study that found out that for blacks and Latinos who want to live in certain neighborhoods, this was a national study, that they would have to earn five times as much as white mortgage applicants who were seeking to buy a home in those particular neighborhoods. I mean, that's just a stunning finding. What would you recommend to sort of start to break those patterns and to have genuine changing patterns to take the title of Jim's studies?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple of different routes that we can take. First of all, increasing just awareness, right? Understanding that FHA loans maybe aren't the top choice, and there are other types of loans, and really beginning to ask the right questions. But at the end of the day, I think we need to be thinking about more asset-based policies, right? How can we create and build assets in communities of color? Because the issues around homes is one thing, but until we have more assets in our communities, and whether it's starting, savings programs for children young, thinking about ways to eliminate college debt or university debt, creating more access to higher education, those are some of the things we need to start thinking about for communities, because we need to be able to build those assets.
Yeah. Well, Linda Sprague Martinez is assistant professor at Boston University School of Social Work. Thank you so much for joining us today. And Jim Campin, professor emeritus at UMass Boston. He conducted the Changing Patterns study. He's been doing it annually for the Massachusetts Community and Banking Council. We'll have a link to the latest one at our website, radioboston.org. Jim Campin, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and you know, it's easy to always criticize the government, but I want to send a heartfelt congratulations to Congress, because Congress managed to move forward a piece of bipartisan legislation. Of course, it's not on health care or jobs or tax reform. Congressional negotiators reached an agreement late last night to keep the government funded through the end of September. The House and Senate are expected to vote on the $1 trillion spending package this week, and that would make it the first piece of bipartisan legislation signed under President Donald Trump. And joining us now to discuss this and more from Washington is Massachusetts Congressman Michael Capuano. Congressman, it's great to have you back.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so I was kind of being tongue-in-cheek there, but not really, because at this point,
at this point,
I'm keeping the government open. It's a big deal. So what's in this deal that you like?
The fact that the government stays open, it's like any big piece of legislation. There's lots of things I don't like, but many things I like. I like the increase in the NIH funding. I like the fact that Planned Parenthood wasn't targeted. I like the fact that cities and towns are not targeted, and that we continue along a comparable path that we are on now relative to across-the-board priorities.
Yeah, so let me...
It's not what I want, but it's a deal.
Okay, so let me just fill in some of the details here. That NIH funding, you're talking about an additional, $2 billion for the NIH? Cities and towns, is that you referring to the fact that there are no cuts for sanctuary cities and towns as the...
That's the major item.
Yeah, that the administration had threatened to. And also, there's this. There's an explicit restriction to block funding for the president's border wall in there. That's more than Democrats were hoping they could get.
I think that's correct, but it turns out that a lot of the Republicans, especially those that represent areas along the Mexican border, don't like the idea of the fence. I guess they remained quiet for a long time, but now that it's potentially real, they have finally had to vote on it, and they weren't happy about it.
Yeah. So what is it that you don't like in the bill?
I don't like some of the – we just continue doing the same we've been doing for the last couple of years. It's not really any change in policy. No deal about infrastructure, no deals about housing. Again, they don't get hurt, but there's no significant policy adjustment to it. Nothing on energy, you know, those kinds of things. Again, they're not bad. They're not negatively impacted, but they are certainly not helped.
Congressman, if I may, you know, nothing on housing, nothing on energy, you know, those small things that the entire country has been debating vigorously for years now.
But you know, the Democrats are the minority party, and we are the ones who generally push things like housing and infrastructure and things like that. And to be perfectly honest, I've been in a more defensive mode than I have been offensive since the election, because we lost the election, they won it. So I think that's my most important role at the moment.
Yeah. Well, I'm seeing, though, that the bill is increasing some spending on infrastructure, for example, and that could have impact here on Massachusetts. I mean, you know, are we going to see a Green Line extension soon?
Yeah, that's going to happen. That one's in the pipeline from day one.
Yeah.
The question is, will we see a South Coast Rail? Will we see a Springfield High Speed, and on and on and on? And, you know, I would not say no, but I would say that they are not, they're not funded, and those kinds of projects are not funded. The Green Line, it happens to be funded because it's pretty far down the road relative to the process.
Okay. Well, let me ask you, Congressman. It seems as if, I mean, one read of this could be that the White House actually gave up a lot of concessions to the Democratic Party, because what they really want to do is clear the decks for their new health care bill. Is that on your mind?
Sure, it's on my mind. I don't know that that's the case. I mean, I don't think this won't have much of an impact on the health care bill. They have the problems they had last week are the same problems they have today in the health care bill. They can't make it work, even on their own side, never mind trying to reach out to Democrats. To my knowledge, they have not reached out to any Democrats in a serious way. So I guess it clears the decks politically. They can move on to it, but they still don't have the votes.
Yeah, but they don't. I mean, Gary Cohn, the chief economic advisor for the president, has been saying that, quote, we're going to get health care down on the floor of the House. We're convinced we've got the votes.
Well, good luck. Yeah. I mean, to be perfectly honest, it's like everything else. You never hear any presidential administration say we can't get something done. They all say they can, and they, who knows? I'm not going to say they can't. The president has a lot of levers he can pull, and if he figures out how to do it, he might get the votes in the House. I think it'd be even harder in the Senate, because you know, it's awfully hard for members of Congress to go back to their constituents and say, yeah, we get rid of that Obamacare. Some people will cheer, but that means, you know, no pre-existing conditions. So, yes, you have access to insurance, but you can't afford it. And if you're a pregnant woman, no way you're going to get health insurance. You know, the devil is in the details that some people don't understand. But the longer this goes on, the more the American people will understand it, and the more difficult it will be for them to pass it.
Hmm. So tell me something, Congressman. I mean, you know that the president in the past couple of days tweeted, and he tweets every day practically, but he mentioned that he thinks the Democrats now are the party of no, that the Democrats are the ones who aren't interested in getting anything done in Washington. Now, I fully understand that Democrats viewed the GOP as absolutely the party of no for the entire time that President Obama was in office. But are you concerned at all that your party's desire to stop these bills that are coming down the pike from the GOP now could end up working against you?
Not yet. I mean, if they get to be closer to reasonable, that may be the case. But I don't think you find too many Americans who actually think the bills that we have been saying no to are reasonable. For instance, we said yes to a reasonable bill, this funding bill. We said yes. So you get us something reasonable, and we'll work with you. And it is significantly different than what the Republicans did to Obama. If you remember, Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Republican Senate, said on the first week of Obama's presidency that his main job was to make him a failed president. And no Democrat has said that. No Democrat has implied that. You know, we may oppose the president's policies as espoused and as put forward. But that's not because I don't like the president. It's not because I have a personal vendetta. It's because the policies are wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to just bring it back here to Massachusetts for a second, because you're paying, what, $50,000 or providing $50,000 from your campaign to help for two free weeks on the Fairmont commuter line starting next week. This is the line that runs from Hyde Park through Dorchester and Mattapan, ends in South Station. $50,000 for your own campaign for free rides on the Fairmont line. Why are you deciding? Why do you want to do that?
A couple of reasons. I mean, once I learned that the Fairmont line had been subject to what I consider to be discriminatory treatment in a negative way, we had to get that cleaned up, and it's been cleaned up to all my understanding. They no longer get treated that way. At the same time, the Fairmont line is kind of like the poor cousin of all the commuter rails. They have the worst service, the most infrequent service. And because of the fact that it was being treated badly, particularly badly, it didn't have any consistency whatsoever, way beyond any other line. And when you don't have consistency, you cannot build ridership. So this is an attempt to try to get people to accept that the Fairmont line has a new way to do business. It is more reliable, and it is a good alternative to driving or taking the bus.
Yeah. Do you, just a couple seconds we have, Congressman, I mean, would we also, we'd like to see a longer-term permanent fix for the Fairmont line, right?
Oh, it'd be great. I mean, but again, that is directly tied to ridership. If we can push ridership up, we have a stronger argument to make those arguments.
Well, Michael Capuano represents Massachusetts' 7th District. He's speaking with us today from Washington. Congressman Capuano, thank you so much. It's always great to have you.
Thank you. Take care.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.